Hi, I'm Matthew Blades, and Learn from People Who Lived It has a great partner, ASI, or Advanced Systems Integration. They design and install cutting-edge audio and visual equipment. This woman-owned small business is big enough to find a solution for your next corporate build-out or school project, and can even slide in to service your existing system. Bring in ASI and 2 decades of AV experience. I hope you'll visit their website at asi-av.com to see their gallery of work.
Welcome to another episode of Learn from People Who Lived It.
My name is Heather, and I am 45 years old.
What story are you here to share?
I guess the story I'm here to tell today is about my perseverance, my struggles through addiction, and where I'm at today.
Who do you hope hears this?
Any woman or man who is struggling with depression, anxiety, grief, or loss.
She was 18 years old when she went to rehab for the very first time. Her mom died when she was 21. And she's here today to talk about the hardest, or the person that was the hardest to forgive. And I think you will be impressed by her answer. Troy DeSmit is alongside Heather. And Heather, welcome to our podcast. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Boy, I mean, and I just scratched the surface there, because your life is one of lots of colors. And you said to me in one of our very first notes, and Troy, I had not shared this with you yet, but she said to me in one of her notes, she said, like, I don't know how many years ago, she said, I couldn't string a sentence together. And now you are somebody who is not only been married for 6 years, or with the same guy for 6 years, and married for the last three, but and you're a leader in your community, and now you're helping the same group of people that, you know, you once were a part of.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, you're really somebody who's gone into this thing and come out the other side with this incredible energy. And I think that's what brought you to this party here, because you feel compelled to share your story, don't you?
I do.
Yeah. So I like to work chronologically. I think that makes things the easiest to digest. So let's talk a little bit about Heather, the little girl. Where did she grow up? What was her home life like? Mom and dad dynamic, all of that stuff up until maybe 12 years old.
Okay. So I was born in Santa Ana, California. I was raised in Yuba City, California. I am the baby of 5 children. My mom was married 3 times. So my father was her last husband, and my brother Charles and myself were her last babies. I guess, you know, growing up, I was sheltered from a lot of things that as an adult I learned of my mom and her marriages and, you know, men in her life that were not ideal or abusive. My dad was in the service. So he was in the Marines when I was little. And I remember missing him a lot, you know, like I would cry if I'd get in trouble. I was about 5 and I would cry, I want my daddy. And then shortly after that, when my dad got out of the service, they divorced. So he was, I guess, there the best that he could be. I have no ill will towards my mom or my dad. I think, you know, the circumstance, it was kind of normal for me not to have a permanent or a steady father in my life. So and as sad as that sounds, like, it was my norm.
You know, there's a lot of moving parts for the first 10, 15 years of somebody's life that you're going through there. What was the dynamic like when the divorce took place?
So my siblings did not like my dad, so they were happy. I missed my dad, you know, but then again, I grew up with, you know, we lived, I think we were stationed out in Santa Ana, like on military base or something like that. Like I said, my details are a little, you know, blurry because I wasn't told a lot, not until I got older. But you know, I was saddened, my older brothers and sisters, not so much. You know, apparently my dad was not the greatest to my mom. I never saw that. You know, again, I was little, so I was spared that. It wasn't until I was about 11 or 12 when my mom's longtime boyfriend, his name was Mac, I witnessed abuse, you know, verbal, emotional, physical. I never saw him hit her, but I did witness my mom breaking a glass table, like a round tabletop, over his head. But that was like my first introduction to the violence.
And you're how old?
I'm 11, I believe, at this time. I had just moved back with my mom. Because age of 8, I lived with my dad. My mom went to jail for welfare fraud. I think she was collecting welfare and was working. So, and again, I didn't even find this out until my 30s. I'm like, why did mom go to jail? You know what I mean? Right. So my sister finally told me it was welfare fraud. I was like, okay. But she served like 2 years in jail for that. And I lived with my dad for a year. That's when my brother, we call him Bubba. That's Charles. When my brother and I lived with my father in Reno, Bubba was very abusive towards me. Like, he would hit me, tell me, clean the house. You know, like, I mean, like, if I was a grown man, you know, like, and then, but apparently that's what he witnessed, you know, and he's a year older than me. So he's 9, I'm 8. And I would cry and I would like, stop. And then I'm like, I'm telling dad when he gets home. And then he would beg and plead, like, please, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. But I went through that for a year. He apologized when we were like 13 or 14 for that. Like, he's like, I'm so sorry, Heather, I didn't. He's like, I don't know why I did that. And I'm like, okay. You know, and we were really close. Like, we were like as thick as thieves when we were younger.
I like to ask, as long as we can, in the story, how do you think those things played out in your adult years, in your adult relationships with men that you tried to get with, you know, relationships that you would try to form, be it a relationship at work or a relationship for, you know, intimacy? How did the first few years of your life impact you there?
Very insecure. Like, I was 15 when I met my oldest son's dad. I had my son at 16. So I have a 28-year-old son. His name is Kevin. I had him at 16 years old. And I thought that was going to be my freedom, right? Like, I'm not under, nobody can tell me what to do. I'm grown. You know, I can do what I want. And, you know, I was, so I thought at the time, madly in love with this kid, right? He's 6 months younger than me. So I think he was 15 at the time. And it was not like, so my standards were not very high, you know, like, he had been in and out of California Youth Authority, from the time he was 13. And so was my brother, Bubba. You know, they did the juvenile hall, and then, Craig got, arrested for burglarizing his neighbor's house and got a 7-year sentence at the age of 13. And he maxed out of California Youth Authority when he was 21. So you go in a boy and you come out not a very structured or good man, but, you know, and
there's some growing up that took place. There's no question about it.
Absolutely. And so he was institutionalized. You know, he had a rough background, but then it, you know, we got into drugs. And, you know, he got arrested until I think my son was 2 when he finally got out. He got arrested when I was pregnant, and he didn't get out until my son was 2. He was out for a few months and then went back until my son was 5. So, you know, and then I had dated another. So when I was like 17 or 18, I started seeing another gentleman, but I left him for Craig. You know, I just kept going back to Craig, like, you know, oh, he's going to get out. We're going to be a family. I love him. I have his baby. And then it got abusive, you know, like, he was my first introduction into, I guess, what I thought love was.
Yeah. You know? Well, and doesn't this seem like a great place to try talk about generational cycles? It really does. It's screaming at me right now because it's your entire, like, as you're coming up, Heather, right? Like, your entire world is this. Every man in your life is just repeating behavior, repeating behavior, right. Repeating behavior. It's like you could write the script and they're all going to do it. And so, Troy, I know that you may not have all the answers, but you have some. How do you break a generational cycle like that?
Well, first thing I think is that you have to become aware of it, and it takes time for that to develop until you can eventually take a look at your life and look back at your life and see the patterns. And then once the pain or the realization occurs to you about that awareness, then you can go back and you can work through the meanings you've made about your life and the stories that you've told yourself for those past years. And then learn about your parents and where they came from and the challenges and issues that they've dealt with. You know, once you can do that, then you can start taking a look at the patterns and really understand what place you're making decisions from in the men that you're choosing to live with, to be with.
That was... you know, I always told myself I would never let a man hit me. I'm never going to do this. I'm never, you know, I always said I'm never. And then I let this one man do it one time and then escalated, you know, push came to shove, shove came to a slap. Then it was closed fist. And then it was breaking lamps and irons over my head, you know, like by the hands of this man, I should be dead three times, you know?
Yeah. Heather, how long into your relationship with this man did the until the abuse began?
Shortly after my mom passed away, when I was 21, I let him. I had already moved to Arizona, and I was, you know, like at 18, I had done my first stint of rehab. I was doing good. I got my first job. I got my first car. My first apartment, you know, at the age of 21, you know, 2 years into this, I'm doing pretty good for myself. I'm making a, you know, life for me and my son. I chose to let him back in because, you know, he said, oh yeah, we can make this work, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, okay. My sister and my brother-in-law were so against it. They're like, no, Heather, don't do that. You know, and this is before the abuse. It took about 6 months for it to become physical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In hindsight, Heather, did you see or experience any red flags that caused you to kind of raise your awareness and go, well, maybe this isn't going to work out? Or what was going through your mind?
I was oblivious to anything and everything. Everybody around me could see it.
Yeah.
Everybody told me.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, that's not true. I don't see that. Oh, now I'm like, okay, there were a lot. So he watched his dad abuse his mom, right? So I think the trigger was when, I guess a red flag for me was he told me, he's like, I could see why my dad beat my mom. And he said that to my face. And this is before the actual physical came, right? Like the threat and the intimidation. And I was sassy, right? I was like, I've got big brothers that, you know, made me tough. So I would push it. You know what I mean? I'm not going to pretend that I did not push his buttons, because I did. So I take ownership of my mouth. In hindsight now, it's like no man has any right to put their hands on a woman, no matter, I mean, walk away, right? The bigger thing would be you need to be man enough or woman enough to walk away. And we were both immature, young, first loves.
Yeah.
Well, and I also think, don't you guys agree, it plays into everything you saw as a child? I mean, so much of that behavior was normalized for you.
Right.
I mean, it's really important that people cue into that part of your story So yeah. much of what you saw as a kid normalized so many things for you that, and so of course you have a tolerance built up. Of course your patience mm-hmm. is stronger. You've been forced to deal with this part all mm-hmm. your life. I mean, I always tell people you were built for the moment, literally, whether that's good yeah. or bad, you were built for the moment.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I was, and because you're right, that was my norm. Like that was, oh, you're going to put your hands on me. You must really love me. It's like, no, you no, hello. Like my husband now, he's amazing. He would never think about putting his hands on me, you know, and I'm quick with the tongue, right? So I have to catch myself because I can be pretty mean with my words, you know, like saying the F word or F you, and, you know, like, and he's like, why are you talking? I'm like, I'm sorry. You know what I mean? Or, but I can say I'm sorry today, you know, before I wouldn't be able to see any of that in myself, but I've come so far. Like if I think it's a blessing how we met, you know, in God's timing, and somebody who truly cares about me, somebody who has my back, somebody who is not jealous or insecure to where he's kind of trying to dictate what I can and cannot do, what I can and can't wear, or, you know, and that's how it was with other relationships. Like, you're wearing that, you know, back in the day when I was cute and skinny, you know? So, well,
and what I will always wonder too is, when you get into a pretty, let's call it normal relationship for the sake of lack of a better word, right? Were there ever times where you kind of almost missed the drama, or you found yourself wanting to poke the bear to stir it up just a little yep. bit, because to get back yep. into that feeling? Yeah. Cause that's important to talk about, right? That happens. Yep.
And with this relationship, I was single for 5 whole years before I met my husband. So like I had a really good chance and time to get to know me, to get to know what I liked, to get to know what intimacy without drugs was, you know, to get to know what somebody genuinely doing something for me and not wanting anything in return, right? Yeah. Like I'm so suspicious, you know, back in my day, I'd be very suspicious. If you were nice to me, you wanted something, mm-hmm. you know, not just because you're a kind person and you're doing it with no expectation. In my mind,
so you assumed the kind of the manipulative behavior of a man if they were doing something nice for you, you assumed automatically that it was a manipulative behavior. Yep. Yeah,
I was for her. I was trained that way, you know.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
it was told to me by Craig, like, oh, he's doing something nice for me just to be doing something nice. No, he wants something from you. So yeah. that brings me back to a situation I was, and we were still using at this point. I was just done with, right? Like I left him so many times. And one of the last times I left him, he came to my sister's house and she said, Heather, if you leave with him, I will never help you again. And she was true to her word because I left with him. And he called her and he's like, ha ha, bitch, I won. I don't even want her, but you can't have her. You know what I mean? And that was with my own sister. He was so manipulative and so controlling that he made it to where my family didn't want anything to do with me because they could not stand the fights between us. And, you know, Shannon got away from that. She was, you know, young when she married, but she married an amazing man who kind of took her out of that. And then she did everything that she could to try to get me out of that as well. And so like, she was my strong support and he made it a point to where I didn't have that, you know, she was all I had and he took that from me.
So how about that insidious behavior, that insidious abuse, and how was there a slow buildup and an escalation of the abuse?
Yeah.
It occurred.
So over a couple of years span, I became homeless. You know, I was homeless. He was cheating on me. You know, we would leave each other. We were so like that love hate thing, but one of the times that I was absolutely done, I was just like, I'm done, right? He he lured me in to our, we'll call him a friend, acquaintance apartment. He's like, all right, just come get your stuff. Give me my stuff. You know, he was too nice. He's like, we're cool. He goes, I'll just give you your stuff. You just give me whatever. And then I'm like, all right. So we meet at this guy's house, apartment. He lures me in and he opens the door. And as soon as I step in the door, he hits me in the back of the head. And I fell to my knees. I'm like, what the fuck? Mm. And then there was three grown men in this house. And they're like, whoa, what's going on? What's going on? And he had a knife in his hand and he told all three men, shut the fuck up and get the fuck out of here. And I was like, don't leave me. I'm like, we can take him. I'm like, there is four of us and one of him. We got this. All three of those men put their tail between their legs and they walked out. Mm. He stabbed me twice. Mm. He was getting ready to go for my face and I put my foot in his throat. So I'm like leaning in the back of the couch at this point. And I'm like, whatever, my instincts kicked in. So I kicked him in his throat. And so he was caught off guard. And then I was trying to run out the house and he beat me. He beat me for 7 hours telling me, shut the fuck up, stop screaming or I'm going to kill you. And I'm like, stop hitting me. You know, like every time I'd scream, he'd hit me.
Yeah.
I'd cry again, like, stop crying. And he was like, and I was like, stop hitting me. And then that went on for 7 hours. We had people come in, buy drugs from him while this was going on. His mom came in and I'm bandaged up at this point. I couldn't move my arm. And I'm sitting on the couch and his mom goes, what's wrong with her? And he goes, oh, she ran into my knife. Ha ha. And she's like, what? No, she didn't. And then they didn't care. And they left. Yeah. So the gentleman, so after hours and hours, he's like, get up. And then he got me high. You know, I'm like, okay. And this is how sick I was and how much in my disease I was. Like, I'm like, hell yeah, I want to get high. He called.
Who wouldn't want to escape that moment, Heather?
Absolutely.
Right? Of course.
And he called this guy that we know. He was a veterinarian. And he's like, hey, I need you to bring your suture kit over. And he's like, what's going on? He's like, well, I'll tell you when you get here. And then, you know, he's thinking it's an animal or something. And then he showed him my arm and he's like, bro, she needs to go to the hospital. He's like, no, she's not going anywhere. And he's like, I can't. He's like, I'm going to kill her. That would hurt. She needs to go to the hospital, get that cleaned and stitched up. And he convinced him to just leave that. Like, he was going to stitch me up himself, right? I was like, oh, my God. Yeah. We end up. Yeah. So we passed out. Get up the next day. He's got to go to work, right? And he's threatening my life. Don't go anywhere. Blah, 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 blah. I start to make a run for the door. And this is like 7 o'clock in the morning. He ends up choking me out to the point where I lose consciousness and I urinated on myself. And he's in between my legs. He's got his one leg in between my legs and he's straddling me and he's choking me. And I come to after I peed on myself, he kind of stopped and he's like, what the hell? And I didn't even know that I woke up peeing on myself. Mm-hmm. He thought it was funny. He ends up going to work. And I run downstairs and I call 911 and they get there. And so like, there's a search going on. I go to the hospital. They had to reopen, you know, they were cleaning the wound, stitch me up. And then I asked the doctor, I'm like, why? I'm so embarrassed. I smell like pee. And I'm like, why did I pee on myself? Because when you die, you lose control of your bodily functions. Oh my God. And I just looked at me. He goes, do you know how close you were to death? And I shook my head. No, I was like, no.
This is all unbelievable. And then your mom dies when you're 21 years old.
Yeah. And I'm only 23 at this point. So this is like 2 years later.
Yeah.
Right.
It's not that long ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that occurs to me is what you said earlier, Heather, around how you had said the boundary. Nobody's going to beat me up. I'm not going to allow that. Mm-hmm. You know, So you had this boundary that you established with yourself and how nobody is going to hurt me. Nobody's going to hit me. You know, similar to the way you'd experienced in your past. And yet when it happens, it's a shock to the system. And I think it's really important that, you know, it sounds like later on you've established those boundaries, but then also the importance of how we enforce those boundaries and what enforcing boundaries really means. Because when we're in an abusive relationship, the odds of the man that you were with changing with you is almost nil or nothing. Mm-hmm. And so truly the only way in that type of a situation for you to have enforced that boundary that you established would have been to leave that relationship.
Yeah.
And what dawns on me is the stories we tell ourselves about how, you know, when we're young and we fall in love and we think it's going to last forever.
Yeah.
Or we meet a person and we put a label on them, like, you know, she's my soulmate. She's my twin flame. He's the love of my life. All of these things that we say or make these labels of really prohibit us from enforcing those boundaries that, oh, now I have to work harder not to please him. How do I do that? So now it becomes a situation where we're working to please them and we're walking on eggshells to not upset them, to not get hurt. And, how important for you, I'm curious about when you decided to enforce that boundary, because that's another thing the abusers are going to do, right? They're going to try to separate you from all those people that support you, that truly love you. They're going to separate you. And once they've
happened, Troy. Yep.
Yeah. So I'm curious, when did you ultimately decide that this was
the very first time this man put his hands on me, I left him. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, hell. And that was just a push. He pushed me into the wall so hard. And I was like, oh, hell no. And I packed my son and I packed my car and we went to my sister's. So what the kicker was is like, and I was strong in that belief, like, oh, no, you know, I'm not going to have this. He would tell me everything I wanted to hear. And my sister, I love her. God bless her heart. But like, you know, she knew this was coming and she wasn't afraid to tell me, I told you so. So I didn't need to hear that at that time, you know? And so I love you. I'm sorry. I'm going to kill myself. I need you. Come back. I told you so. See, he's a piece of shit. I told you so. You know what I mean? So like I ran to what I wanted to hear.
Yeah.
And I wanted to hear, I love you. I wanted to hear, I need you. I can't live without you, you know, as a 21-year-old wanting to hear these things.
Yeah,
but then I go back and then it got worse. So the next time it was a slap in the face. Hmm. I'd leave. I'd come back. That's when my sister set that boundary the last time I left with him. Because I would leave every time he put his hands on me, I'd leave him. You know what I mean? Thinking that I was strong in my belief and I was a stronger person than that. Hmm. No. And I used to tell him, I don't need you. I want you. I invited you into my home, into my life because I figured we could make this work. Oh, he didn't like that because he made it a point to where when I did not want him anymore, I needed him. Mm. He took everything, you know, like my family set their boundaries with me. Like, and I only had my sister. She's like, nope. She would not open the door to me.
Yeah.
She took my son in at one point when I was homeless on the streets, slamming dope. She's like, I'll help your son, but I will not help you. I will not take you in my home. And she was true to her. So she had amazing boundaries, you know?
Yeah, and what a difficult thing for your sister to do to let her little sister go on her own journey to find her own way, and to know that that's not good for her to bring you in and to enable you to continue to go back to him. So good on your sister for doing that. That's an incredibly difficult thing to do, to let someone that we love go when we know it's not in their best interest.
You know, I want to talk about your son a little bit because, you know, well, all of these things that you're telling us are, you know, at least to me, I mean, they're incredible stories of the things you've witnessed. I mean, it's the kind of things you see in movies, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And yet you're like, you're firsthand. This is your life. This isn't somebody's script. And so I want to double down a little bit on what I think Troy was asking, which is, what was the aha moment? When did you finally, Heather, decide enough of this bullshit? I'm so like, when did you finally love yourself enough to flip the switch?
When he went to prison. I don't have a good answer for you, Matthew, because it wasn't until, so it wasn't on my own that I, you know, it was when he was finally locked up and I had a space to breathe that I was like, okay, you know, I got to do better.
So he's in prison and you finally decide, okay, it's time for me to figure out who I am without this individual.
Yes.
And I asked you in our conversation before we recorded this podcast, I said, who was the hardest person to forgive? You mind sharing your answer with everyone?
Myself. Absolutely. I had the hardest time forgiving myself for allowing things to happen to me, for allowing my son to live with my sister, because I couldn't get my head out of my ass long enough to be a mom, to be a decent sister.
I know this from my own self, right? And everybody's got different stories and different characters in their own thing. But, you know, when I was really going through the hard time, I know I wasn't treating people the right way. And then when you come out the other side, it's like, oh man, you just feel such remorse for the person that you were, for the, you know, for the decisions that you allowed to happen to you, for all of the things, right? But you have to battle through that, because those are just thoughts. Those are just things you think. They are not who you are. And so let's spend a minute talking about this forgiveness bit. I mean, which of these things was hard for you? There must have been a couple that stood out.
I think the hardest part for me was, you know, for 10 years, I didn't raise my son because of all this, you know? I was so consumed in my own guilt, my own crap, that in my mind, I was like, okay, I know my son is being taken care of. He's being loved. He's fed, things that I did not have the means to do. It wasn't until, you know, and then I remember when I got pregnant with my second son, my kids are 14 years apart. So when I got pregnant with Caden, I was still slamming dope. I was homeless. I was bouncing from house to house. At that point, I'm like, okay, so I can either be a great drug addict or a great mom. I can't be both, right? And I hit my knees one night, you know, I'm still staying with whoever I can. I have a little baby. I go to Walmart and I steal some diapers and formula and, you know, things that he needed. And the night before, I hit my knees and I was praying to God. I'm like, I can't do this. This sucks. Please help me. I got arrested the next day. And that, believe it or not, saved me, because I was able to get some clarity while in jail, you know, like, My friend Lisa took care of my son while I was in jail for like 3 months. And then that's where my journey to recovery begins. So lost. I was so broken. I was numb. You know, I had the luxury of getting high. My kids don't. You know what I mean? Like, Kevin didn't have the luxury of drowning his pain out with the substance, you know? So that was hard to forgive. It was really hard to forgive.
Yeah, but so important that you do, because you can live in the guilt, which will only perpetuate everything that's happening, or you can make the choice to move on and raise him from a new operating system, which is what you're doing.
Yeah, and that took years of counseling.
It has to. And that's just the thing. I mean, listen, when I got together and decided that I wanted to put on this movement, learn from people who lived it, this is the whole premise, right? Is that I hope there's somebody listening to us right now that goes like, holy shit, me too. I feel the same way. I had a similar experience, whatever. And then I'm hoping that they go, yeah, maybe I should go talk to somebody. Maybe I should find a church. Maybe I should find a good friend and give me good advice. You know, whatever that looks like. And then, you know, we hope that people want to come back and share their story when they're kind of on the other side and feeling like they're ready too. And so it makes such wonderful sense, all of the things that you're telling me. And I'm sure that people who are listening to us right now feel the exact same way I did the first time that I talked to you. It's like, you don't sound like this could have ever been you, right? Like, that's such a wild, different character in the movie. You must feel like a different person.
I do. I feel empowered. I feel strong. I feel I'm so independent that, you know, like before I was dependent on anybody and everybody. And now, you know, I have amazing people in my life. I have a group of women that support me and love me unconditionally. I have an amazing job. I have a good relationship with my kids. Caden has never known me anything but sober. I will be celebrating 14 years on October 5th. And, you know, that's led me to, so, you know, all these years of, you know, learning to accept help and with that means, you know, taking medication for depression and anxiety, because, you know, like I had mentioned before, I was so against that because, you know, my mom was diagnosed bipolar, my brother schizophrenic, and I'm like, I don't want to be in that same category. And yet my brain chemistry from all the using, from all the trauma, like it just wasn't, you know, running right. And, you know, they would tell me before, oh, it's situational depression. I'm like, well, yeah, my situation sucks. So yeah, this is depressing. And I just couldn't get out of that. Like, I'm like, I'm usually happier. I'm usually bubbly. And like, there was just this fog. And then finally, one of the ladies that I look up to from NCADD, her name is Thelma. She's like, if you, you know, she put it in like a health perspective, like for diabetes, you know, you would take your meds for diabetes, right? To help, you know, control your blood sugars. I'm like, of course. And she's like, well, why wouldn't you do that for your brain? You know, I'm like, she just put it in a way that it clicked for me. I'm like, okay. And then I started taking, you know, some medications and I was feeling a little bit better. And I was like, oh, okay, you know, My brain isn't the healthiest and it just needed that kickstart to get there. Right. Besides, because I was doing, you know, the counseling and this, that, and I'm like, okay, I'm not better. What is wrong with me? I thought something was wrong with me. And I was just, it was clinical depression, not situational, because my situation was great. You know, I'm living life. I'm sober. You know, I'm in treatment, blah, blah, blah.
I'd like to sort of, come to a little bit of a close and ask you a few questions. I want to ask you a couple of things that have come to my mind as we've kind of been talking and going through this whole process. So, all right, we're here. We're on the other side of a lot of noise. And now you have an opportunity to, you know, say something either to yourself or to somebody who's listening to this and saying, okay, I'm in a similar situation. What do they need to hear to walk away? What do you know they need to hear to walk away?
Oh, gosh. Know that that is not love. Like, no matter how, and abusers are manipulative. They're going to pull at your heartstrings. They're going to lie to you. They're going to threaten their own lives, threaten your family. Leave, leave, leave. You've got to cut that tie. You got to cut. So like I had to pray, you know, I remember praying like, please, Lord, give me the strength to just cut the ties with this person. And I finally was able to, you know, like just say enough is enough, but you can't go back. You know what I mean? You've got to, and that's the hard part, is because these people are so manipulative and they will do anything and say anything, but it's not love. It is not love. It's abuse. And love don't hurt.
Yeah. The last question that I want to ask you is about where you are now in your life. You mentioned to me in an email that you're the kind of woman other women look up to now. So tell me a little bit about that story.
So yeah, now I work at Arizona Women's Recovery Center. Before that, so I got my education. I went to college, you know what I mean? I was working in the behavioral health field for 7 years at LifeWell, with working with the SMI population after I got my peer support training, after I went, you know, all the things. So now I work for an amazing company that saved my life, Arizona Women's Recovery Center. When I interview these women before they come in, you know, they're like, one, you know, we get to share our little bits of our stories where we came from and just kind of have that conversation. And, you know, they're like, oh, I'm proud of you. That's what I want. I want what you have, you know? And I'm like, me, you know what I mean? And I never looked at myself that way. I'm like, I pulled myself up from, you know, nothing to what I have now. What I've accomplished is great relationships, a great career. I'm married. I own my own home. I have a vehicle. I have money. If I need to go and get a pair of shoes because mine broke, I have the luxury of having money in the bank to do that, which before, like, I couldn't scrounge 2 cents together. You know what I mean? So, like, I may not have all my wants, but I absolutely have my needs met. And I could not have done it without going through what I went through. I think, like, what I've been through has made me the woman I am today, and I wouldn't change me now for nothing.
You and I have both agreed that we should spend a little bit of time here talking about abuse, talking about how do I leave. And then I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about being a transitional character in your lineage and more on that. But let's dive right into it, man. There was a cycle of abuse there that just was unrelenting.
Yeah, how she started her life and how she continued to go back to her abuser, which is so common in so many of these types of cases, until someone is really gone and realized, you know, number one, I feel low self-esteem. I've really got a problem with how I'm looking at the world, and I need to start thinking about how I can heal and how I can heal my past. And where did these decisions come from? Why do I continue to go back to this person? Where is that coming to from within me? Especially considering when we were listening to her talk earlier, how she had decided that no one was going to hurt her and no one. And then it happened, which is a shock. And, you know, establishing boundaries is really one thing, and being really crystal clear about boundaries. When I think of boundaries within a marriage, I think of the three A's. I think of abuse, and that can include manipulation. I think of adultery, and I think of addiction. The three A's are bottom line for me. And what I've instructed my daughters and my son is, if any of those three are taking place in your relationship, you are not obligated to stay, regardless of whether or not you said I do, and until death do us part. Those are three bottom line boundaries that I'm going to establish, and then I'm going to enforce. And enforcing boundaries in an abusive relationship, in a manipulative relationship, is very difficult to do. It requires an act of courage, an act of faith, and a real willingness to do whatever it takes to separate yourself and remove yourself from that relationship. That can require getting in a vehicle and driving away and not looking back. That can require taking off someplace and not going back to it. And when they come back, and they often do come back, when the abuser comes back or finds you, it's leaving immediately. It's disconnecting and cutting the cord from social media. It's disconnecting and cutting the cord from our texting, from the phone. Really, it requires an extreme in making that disconnection happen and not going back, as hard as it is, and then finding someone that can support you and that can help you in that process. She had grown comfortable with her abuser. As crazy as that sounds, it's what she knew. And it's why she kept going back. And it takes an incredible amount of courage to cross over into the unknown, to where she's able to begin to find clarity in her life. Because, you know, a manipulative relationship or an abusive relationship, it causes us to look in the mirror and question our own worth, our own sanity. I give her a lot of credit for doing it and for being able to tell her story and to share that. And I hope that, you know, anyone that's going through any of these types of abusive situations takes her message to heart and has the courage to get up and to step into the unknown and to find that helper and that mentor that can lead them out and back into who they really are, so that they're able to share their own story and they're able to help others also by offering their own hand and their own wisdom and their journey to others, so that we can continue to pull ourselves up and help one another.
I love the power behind transitional character in my lineage, right? Like, I feel like that's my new superhero power. And I'm not joking. Man, I'm the transitional character in my lineage. Like, not only is it important that you get up and you do something about it, like, it's critical. It's critical. You're the person. You're the transitional character. It's your job to get out of this rut, this awful circle, this awful circumstance, and make a better life for yourself. That's your job.
Right.
And boy, when I bought into that, Troy, that changed so many things for me. And I hope it changes so many things for others.
Owning that transitional character, taking responsibility for that character. And quite honestly, I think that's what a spiritual warrior is. Someone who accepts it, embraces the role, and really has a joy in going about their business, in clearing up those things in their life, and hopes that it doesn't pass down to the next generation. That's, I think, a spiritual warrior. It's not necessarily the one that's going out and telling everybody what they should or shouldn't do. It's the one that takes it upon himself to make his own decisions and to live it and to make different choices and changing their world and changing the generations that follow.
We have three goals with Learn from People Who Lived It. 1, to help you feel less alone. 2, encourage you to seek out a coach, a therapist, a church, anyone who can help you get through your journey and find some healing. 3, when you're ready, share your story with us.
Thank you for listening to Learn From People Who Lived It. A reminder again that ASI, or Advanced Systems Integration, designs and installs cutting-edge audio and visual equipment. This woman-owned small business is big enough to find an AV solution for your next boardroom, classroom, council chambers, or courtroom. Bring in ASI and 2 decades of AV experience. Visit ASI-AV.com to see their gallery of work.